Hello, it's Landon
and Monique,
and we're coming to you again from Zoom on video Zoom, and we have a special guest today who, unfortunately, the hospital he is at doesn't Zoom super successfully, so he's joining us half video, half by cell phone, so we'll work on that audio, and hopefully it will sound good in the end. Yeah, Monique, why don't you introduce the good doctor.
Our special guest. Well, we're very grateful to have one of our top infectious disease doctors with us. We both have the great pleasure of working with Dr. Robert Reynolds here. And I don't think he's going to need any translation, although he does come from that Emerald Isle of Sligo, Ireland. But I think he's been here long enough that we can understand his accent. I think one of the things about being in this kind of surreal COVID world is that I think most of us could agree that it has been comforting to have our scientists here in Canada and our doctors, our infectious disease doctors, helping us navigate this kind of brave new world, should we say. And so Landon and I felt that it was really helpful to have Dr. Reynolds here to help us kind of navigate some of the questions that we find maybe interesting and a bit confusing. So Robert, I think the first thing I would like to ask you, because it's something that I have been thinking about, is maybe you can talk a little bit about COVID in some general terms. And one of the things that we've noticed is the East Coast and the West Coast seem to have had very different pictures of how COVID has turned out. And is it a different strain, or is it just a different response in combating it that has made the difference? And I'll let you start there.
Sure. There are many variables to consider when you take a look at outbreaks in various different regions. And that could be the fault of the virus, that could be the fault of the host, that could be the fault of the individual healthcare system that's in each area. Sorry, we've got some onlookers here. you don't want to be in the camera? When you take a look at the virus itself, when that virus initially started, it's a RNA virus of a coronavirus family, and it, when it replicates, the enzyme that it uses can make mistakes as it's replicating itself over and over again. This means that there will be variations in the strain as the infection evolves from person to person to person to person. This means that you can take a look at the potency of that virus may change over time, becoming weaker in some strains and becoming more virulent in other strains. In addition, you've got the receptor that the virus binds to, and this virus binds to something called the ACE2 receptor. And when it binds to that receptor, the binding site is not the active site of the receptor, but is adjacent to it. That's important because when you're taking a look at structures or enzymes that are conserved within a species, the active site is often highly conserved and is kept in the same sequence, whereas the adjacent structures can vary over time without affecting the function of that enzyme. Because the virus binds to the outside of that ACE2 receptor rather than the active site, this allows for genetic variation to occur amongst our species. So Monique, your ACE2 receptor's genetic structure is going to be different from mine, is going to be different from Landon's. And if there's a difference in that structure, there's going to be a difference in the binding efficacy of the virus to this. So you'll see that different populations, different genetic populations, may bind that virus differently. And that may have effect on how that virus has the opportunity to replicate within the host. In addition to having differences of the genetic strain of the virus, differences of the genetic strain of the host, you also have got the healthcare system that people are involved in. And we're relatively lucky here in Canada in that we've got a socialized medicine system where people who are ill, people who are sick, can come to the emergency room without fear of any cost to their personal system. Whereas in other systems where you have to pay up front for your healthcare, that may be a factor to see how and when people present to the emergency room, and do they present later on in the course of their illness, which may explain why some of these people who we are seeing presenting to the emergency rooms at the places in the States are actually sicker by the time they present, rather than here in Canada, where they're presenting a little bit earlier. So you've got all these little factors to consider.
So that's it. Go right ahead and drink your Tim's. Very Canadian of him. He's drinking his Tim Wharton's coffee. So, Robert, is that why, you know, when we talked about a vaccine and how everyone keeps mentioning, oh, you know, that's what we're waiting for, the holy grail. If we get the vaccine, life can go back to normal. But I think what you've just told me is that if it mutates, is there such a thing as a vaccine that's going to help to get us back to our new abnormal or whatever that case may be?
Now, there's an interesting one. What I want to believe is that we can make a vaccine that's going to be efficacious and that's going to be protective and it's going to return life to normal. And that's what I want to believe and I want to see happen. The reality may be quite different, because there are viruses that you will develop antibodies to, but those antibodies will not be protective. And you'll see that in the cases of viruses such as HIV or viruses such as hepatitis C. We can measure the antibodies in the bloodstream. Yeah, you can try to develop a vaccine to produce those antibodies, which you could do, but those antibodies will not be protective antibodies. They will not protect you from acquiring the infection. There are other viruses that you can develop a beautiful vaccine to that will be protective. Hepatitis A and hepatitis B are great examples. With the COVID, the concern that we're going to face is, what type of antibodies will we make with this vaccine? Which means you have to be very careful about which strain you're going to be working with, which particular antibody are you going to be promoting when you make that vaccine. And there are many, many, many different vaccines in the pipeline right now trying to answer that question. Can you find the key antibody that's going to be protective, or are you just going to induce an antibody that's not going to make any difference at all to alter that virus when it infects into your body, essentially being a useless vaccine? So that, teasing that bit of information out, is going to take a few years. It's not going to be something that's going to emerge overnight. That's one of the concerns. The second concern is strain variation within that virus. And if you're looking at a virus that will be mutating, will you be looking at the efficacy of that vaccine attenuating or reducing itself over time? So I want to believe the vaccine is going to be the holy grail, but I do have some concerns. And because this is a coronavirus, and those coronaviruses are essentially the cold viruses, we haven't been very successful in making a vaccine against these viruses over the last 50 to 60 years. And I don't think that has changed in the last 3 or 4 months since we've had this. And we know from vaccines for the coronavirus that have been made in the animal population, those vaccines tend to be a bit more harmful than protective. And there are some cases where they've been trying to make the animal vaccines against the coronaviruses for the herd immunity within the animal husbandry situations. And those vaccines have failed, unfortunately, actually causing worse outcomes when the animals caught the disease rather than those who were unvaccinated. So there is another element to developing a vaccine to consider. And coffee time again.
Yeah. I wish everyone could see the video, because Monique and I are staring at the screen. I think our heads are about to explode. Already, this is so well explained and such good knowledge. And Monique's on mute. I'm not sure if she realizes that. And her video. Your video's frozen with your finger in your mouth, Monique, which is always an interesting.
Are you still there, Monique?
Monique pays $5 a month for internet, so she has the slowest speed internet ever. Oh, and she's gone. There you are.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
I don't know, but we thoroughly insulted you while you were gone. So.
Oh, thank God. You'll I just, hate for Dr. Ben. It was worthwhile to tease me then. So what you're saying, Robert, is we still don't have the cure to the common cold, is what you've just explained to me.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. We
haven't cured the common cold yet.
And now we have a little bit more of a common of a not so minor cold that's kind of riding the same wave.
Well, you know, with these coronaviruses, they have jumped into our human population several times over thousands of years. They often start off with an animal reservoir, cross into the human population, and then will spread. And that's happened a few times in our history when we do genetic lineage tracing of the current coronaviruses that are circulating within our species. And this is just another one that has jumped in. Sometimes, if we're really lucky, these very aggressive viruses tend to burn themselves out. Otherwise, they tend to circulate for years and years, eventually weakening in their strain, becoming another strain of the common cold. But that may take 5-10 years to settle out.
A question that I know I've been asked a few times is, so we sort of had a public health response to try and stop this from starting, and that was successful. But in the other side of it is, now this is just kind of in our background, and that people compare it to the Spanish flu, because obviously CNN is, you know, all over comparison. And so we had the Spanish flu that in a sort of uncontrolled pandemic ran through a year and a half. And by putting in some modern public health regime here, are we taking that year and a half and going to now spread that over 20 years? And don't need an opinion on whether that's the right thing to do or not, but epidemiologically, is that likely what's going to happen now, is through all this distancing and things, we're spreading out what would have been an 18-month pandemic, although not burdening our healthcare system in doing so?
The answer to that one depends on the response of the host to the actual virus. If you catch the virus, you have survived the virus, you make antibodies to the virus, and those antibodies are protective against a second infection, then it would be like influenza would be, where yes, you get good herd immunity, you've protected everyone else with that, there's a high prevalence of immunity within the human population, and that will guard against subsequent infection. If, however, you catch the virus, you survive the virus, you make antibodies to the virus, but those antibodies are non-protective, it means that you're going to catch the virus again. Mm. And while you may get a partial response to it, meaning a little bit of protective survival, you will still have that virus circulating and circulating and circulating in the environment. We know in the case of influenza, the antibodies that you make are generally protective antibodies, which is why you'll see strain variation occur from year to year, and why the vaccines are made to try to catch up with those antigenic changes that we see within the virus. With the coronaviruses, with regular cold viruses, you and I and everyone else has probably encountered a situation where you get one cold after another cold after another cold during the winter season, essentially catching one strain after another strain after another strain. It's not terribly severe on you, but it is annoying to catch. And that's what we might be seeing with how this strain may evolve over time for us.
And I'm assuming we're not there yet as knowing what that's going to look like, because it kind of has to run through a population a few times to look for those variations and reinfection.
Exactly. We're still very early on in this, and we don't have enough data yet to see how do those people who have had the coronavirus, what percentage of those guys could get reinfected again, and what that infection is going to look like in there. Is it going to be just as aggressive? Is it going to be very mild? Will they be asymptomatic with it? And will they, if they are asymptomatic with it, then become the source of transmission to the virus to those that have no immunity to it.
Right.
Many, many variables to try to sort out. And that's going to take essentially a few years to give you that data.
Okay.
Perfect. I think that that's very helpful for a lot of people because I you know, you hear all this controversy about, you know, oh yeah, all these great minds, we're going to have a vaccine within a year. This is all going to, you know, and I think that the thing for me is being very cautious about it and saying, let's not just pin all our hopes on one thing. I think what we need to do is just be careful in life in general right now, our new lives, rather than just put all of our hope on one vaccine. And maybe I shouldn't even bring this up because I didn't actually put that as a question, but do you have any thoughts about the I'm scared to even say the word because I know it's been such
the chloroquine.
Well, you know, hydroxychloroquine.
Is it the next best thing to slice bread? well, you know, be honest. If you take a look at how does this drug work, is it actually an drug? What happens is the virus comes along and it binds to this ACE2 receptor on the cell membrane. It gets incorporated into the cell in basically a little vacuole that is now, the virus is bound to the surface of it, it's been taken inside of the cell. The virus is sitting inside this vacuole. It still cannot get out into the cytoplasm where it can start replicating. What happens is a lysosome, which is another little vacuole inside the cytoplasm of your cell containing acidic enzymes, will bind to the vacuole that has the virus. When that happens, the acidity in that lysosome floods into the vacuole. The acidity alters the basically an S protein on that virus, allowing that virus to then merge with that cell wall of the vacuole, bursting it, and essentially throwing that virus into the cytoplasm where it can replicate. So you need the acidity from that lysosome in order to allow that virus to gain entry into the cytoplasm to replicate. What hydroxychloroquine does is it dissolves across the membrane of the cell and will actually bind to the acid, preventing that acid from altering the structural components of the virus, altering that virus from entering the cell. That's the theory behind it. When you take a look at how long we've been trying this drug for, you could actually go to the papers of the Spanish flu and take a look at some of the articles that were going on at the time. And they were saying, you know, try quinine, because that may actually help with this. Quinine became chloroquine, became hydroxychloroquine. The Spanish flu was 1918. We're 2020. We're like 102 years later, still trying to see whether or not this chemical works. And if it hasn't worked in 100 years, it's probably not going to work in the next 3 months. These chemicals, quinine, chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, have been studied as an antiviral agent over and over again as an attempt to see whether or not that mechanism makes a difference to the infection. It hasn't really panned out.
Yeah. I think that's very helpful because that's, to me, that's a much more common sense approach to it instead of us all. I think there's such hope and maybe some desperation that people are kind of reaching for straws. And I don't disagree that we should study it, but I don't think, again, that we should be like, oh, let's, you know, invest everything in that. I think there should be like multiple approaches to see what's the best thing at this moment in time. And we don't want to throw the baby out with the bath water, but I think we need to be cautious and step back and let the scientists look to see if this is helpful and certainly not hurtful. One of the things you mentioned, Landon, and I'd love for you to talk about it because you kind of briefly touched on it, Robert, was about herd immunity. And we're so early on in this COVID struggle that we really don't have the data. And do you find it kind of interesting that Sweden has taken a very different approach where they're, you know, allowing a lot of social things happening in an attempt to get herd immunity? And what do you think about that?
So with that one, it's an interesting experiment. And that's really what it is. You've seen two patterns of behavior on our planet. One is very conservative, to isolate, protect, and minimize the spread of the virus. The other philosophy is to let the virus run wild and see what happens. If this virus does establish herd immunity, which is protective, the price that you're going to pay for that is the initial flood of deaths to your system before you establish it within your population. That's generally what our species has been doing with bat viruses for millions of years on our planet. These viruses would just run through our population, kill off the weak and susceptible, and the rest would remain alive to give you a little bit of immunity to it. What you don't know with this virus is whether or not the immunity that you're getting is actually going to be 100% protective, going to be only partial, or going to be no immunity whatsoever. Yes, you will develop antibodies to it, as the mechanism would be, but the quality of the antibodies that you make, that's where the key comes into place. So while we're seeing this virus spread through the Scandinavian country to see what exactly happens to that population, you'll see the death rates go up in that population, and they're going to be higher than what they're going to be in the rest of the countries. As to how well a second wave then flows through that country, as we're anticipating the second wave to happen this fall, that's where you're going to get the proof in the pudding. That's where you're going to be able to see which countries fare better with this one. If Sweden comes along and has a second wave and they have less deaths as a result of it, then we know that the immunity that you're gaining is going to be protective, essentially an experiment that's being run in our population.
Do you have anything else that you wanted to ask, Landon? You and I are both like staring at Robert like, oh my God, I want to learn and learn and learn.
Batting my eyes like.
I know. Like
I'm so fascinated. We're usually not lost for words, actually, which is kind of interesting. No, go on to your next question, Monique.
I was going to ask you, Robert, do you think, I think we're all kind of sitting here, I think just from a science perspective, I think we're all quite fascinated by watching this kind of disease evolve. Certainly very sad from a human perspective, but from a scientific perspective, it's very, very interesting to see a disease process and how we in the medical profession and how society is managing with this outbreak. And are we doing better than we did during the Spanish flu? And do you think that there are some things that are lessons that you feel that we've learned that we should take forward? Because as you said, this isn't going to go away. This may come up again this fall. Are there things that we can do as healthcare professionals, as communities, to be able to manage this next outbreak, which we are anticipating is going to happen?
Well, I am impressed with the rate at which our technology has focused down on this virus. From the identification of the outbreak, from the identification of the virus, from the sequencing of the virus, from the development of antibody tests to this, it has been extremely impressive over the last several months. And to see the scientific community from across the planet focus on the development and the study of this, that has been fantastic. Mm-hmm. I remember when I started doing PCR 30 years ago, it would be taking years to try to get this up and running and try to develop the sequence. Now these guys are running it within a matter of weeks developing this. So the collaboration has been fantastic.
Yeah.
I think are a few cases where information has been quarantined and not made available. And that, I think, has hindered the development of our understanding of this virus. But I think we've learned that the pressures of the world community on this is that this is an unacceptable behavior. If all of us as a species are going to be implicated by this infection, then all of us should have access to the data and all of us should be collaboration on this in order to come up with a response and to come up with a treatment or a cure or at least a control measure for this. So from a human perspective, I'm impressed to see the collaboration that has evolved over time for this virus and for this approach we've taken. I think that's one of the key lessons that we're going to learn going forward. When the next outbreak occurs, will be no more of this hushing, keeping it quiet, but an immediate notification to all the countries across the world and in a more immediate response.
Yeah. Well, I've been saying for a few months is, and you know, obviously in my mind, this was all going to work. And this, like, it, you know, and I think all three of us actually lived through SARS the first time at that hospital that we were all at. And I think in my mind, this would just be SARS. We would sort of be this little club of people that are dealing with these patients, and the general population wouldn't really know about it. And I think in my mind, I've been thinking, okay, so once COVID goes away, it'll be interesting to see the next virus, and does the whole world shut down in 24 hours in a coordinated way to go, hey, if nobody moves for 7 days, we're good, and this dies out immediately. Obviously, that that was a bit of a dream, because I think this virus is going to be the one we're dealing with for the next few years, and there is going to be no shut the world down and hope it all goes away. So yeah, it's interesting. I agree that some of the lessons we've learned, I'm hoping we keep them, and it you know, obviously we'll be long retired when the next one of these comes along, maybe, and it'll be interesting to see. Do we shut down in a day? And everyone understands what that means, and you don't have the politicizing of it and that sort of thing, because we all know that we have this moment of opportunity that is literally a day or a week long when these things start, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be the great response to be able to see, realizing that a couple of those situations will be overkill, will be overcalled, and it'll be unnecessary. But it prevents this situation from happening again. It's going to be well worth the investment of containment, isolation, stop the travel, close the borders, isolate down until this is under control. And if you do that early on, then yes, Landon, you've stopped all of this chaos from happening.
I think
you're right.
Yeah, I think the other thing for me is that Landon and I often talk about the word failure, and not looking at the word failure as a negative thing, but looking at it as a constructive thing, that there's no judgment around it. But I think it's really important in any kind of a response, or to look back and say, did we have some failures? Did we have some failures in assessing? Did we have some failures in communicating, globally? In how we managed it. And I think one of the things for me that I think what I would like to hold on to as we move forward is that I think that there was a failure in recognizing how rampant it went through our old folks' homes. And I think that that's a lesson that we need to learn as we move forward, is how are we managing, and are there some type of qualifications or accreditation, assisted living homes? Are we paying the healthcare workers there well enough so that they don't have to go from place to place to place to earn a living wage, which may have spread some of that virus through some of our homes? And I think that we need to look at this not just from a scientific perspective, as you first talked about, Robert, is some of the social variants that have caused this to be a huge issue. Where in a lot of other countries, the people who have paid the price are people who have less health coverage, who have a lower socioeconomic group. And they're also the ones who are essential workers, who are in there working and therefore more exposed, and all of those things. So I think that we as a society have a responsibility to take ownership about where we're seeing this virus, and how do we as a society support some of those things like preventative health and access to healthcare, and having people have a living wage so that these things don't happen. And are we protecting the elderly in homes? And when you have private homes, they should still have an accreditation process. So I think for me, it's been quite a eye-opening to see some of the disparity. Even though I inherently knew that, I think it has been a slap in the face, really, for me to kind of think, wow, this is really quite something. And how do we move forward as a society? Because if we don't acknowledge it and we don't fix it, I think that that's problematic. as we move forward. So that's certainly a lesson that I hope that I've learned again and be able to articulate as we look more towards how we vote, how we want our country to run, how do we want a hospital to run, how do we want healthcare to run, how do we, you know, care for folks in homes and things like that. I don't know. Probably very idealistic of me.
As per usual.
As per usual, Miss Pollyanna herself. I'm always going to be, what is it? I'm never going to be Eeyore. Always be a Pollyanna.
Those are all excellent, very good points. And I would certainly echo that with respect to what we know in the past with respect to the influenza outbreaks that we've seen. A lot of them are associated with our healthcare workers moving from one nursing home to another nursing home, a reflection of the fact that they're only working part-time, not getting their full benefits, and have to work at multiple jobs at multiple locations. And while that was deemed acceptable in the past with respect to the influenza, the outbreak that we've had now with respect to the coronavirus has really shown us the consequences of that action, of that behavior. And the mortality that with respect to this in the nursing homes, I'm hoping will be the impetus for change to say that we will no longer accept healthcare workers moving from one place to another place as vectors of transmitting viruses from one nursing home to another nursing home, putting our elderly loved ones at risk. I'm hoping that the governments will say, we're going to stop this behavior, we're going to ban this behavior, we're going to take care of our healthcare workers, we're going to give them a decent wage, make sure that they can be employed and stay at that one location and have no need to go out and seek secondary employment.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the other thing, just from a practical point of view, from an everyday work perspective, since most of the people who listen to us are, you know, in the healthcare field, I think this does change the way that I practice now, right? I mean, wearing my protective gear may be the norm or the abnormal as I move forward from now on. I think I'm going to be much more vigilant about aerosolizing kind of procedures and making sure that I have my eye protection and all that sort of stuff. So I think that that is going to be our norm moving forward. I can't see us decreasing those precautions anytime soon. I don't know, you know, I think that I mourn a little bit that I'm still a pretty touchy-feely person. And I think that that's one of the things that scares me a little bit, because when I communicate with my patients, so often I'm touching them. And so I don't want that not to still occur, but I just need to be able to wash my hands a lot, not touch them and then touch everybody else. So I think that, I think that we can still have the way we usually communicate and how we do it, but we just need to be a bit more cautious about thinking about keeping each of us safe and our patients safe. So maybe still wearing some protective gear when we need to, but if we can socially distance, maybe it's, you know, not necessary. We may have to think about things like, you know, do we all have to go into a room at one point? Like, you know, decreasing the amount of contact and be a bit more efficient in the way that we care for patients and things like that as well. So I think just having that in the front of my head as I approach patients, I think is very helpful moving forward too.
No, I certainly agree. And if you take a look back, what we're essentially learning is we are relearning the late 18th, 19th century approach to medicine over again, where you had your hospitals realizing that there was transmission of infection from person to person to person. We had no therapies for this. And the best thing that we could do was to try to control our exposures, to keep the hospitals clean, to be very proper. You had your head matron on the ward. Everyone was cleanliness next to godliness. Everything was infection control practices at that time. Mm-hmm. And with the development of our antibiotics, with the development of our antivirals and antifungals, we've forgotten a lot of that behavior, and that's fallen by the wayside, and we show up in slacks and t-shirts and transmit the infection from person to person to person without good hand hygiene. We've forgotten all of that over the last couple of decades, and now this is a lesson that as a society, we are relearning again. Something from the 19th century brought back into the 21st century again.
Well, it is the year 2020 and the year of the nurse, you know, and Florence Nightingale was all about cleanliness, right? I mean, that was her whole thing.
I want my year. I want my year back. I want year of the nurse to, like, let's reschedule that. Can we just reschedule it, please? Because we're not getting our good end of this deal right now. We didn't want to be highlighted in this way. I guess a question I have is, obviously, this is, you know, even if we compare to SARS from 2002, is that there was really, like, to be honest, there was really no internet back then in a way it is now. And I find with this that with the social media and internet capabilities now, that information just flies around accurately or inaccurately 5 seconds after it maybe happened or maybe didn't. I'm wondering if you have the two or three places that you get reliable information from that I'm picturing, you know, a nurse in an overwhelmed hospital who's just trying to, you know, maybe being told they don't have PPE anymore and those sorts of things. Where do you go for kind of the best information that you can find right now and not journal published 6 months later kind of information, but kind of some live stuff and reputable sources that you consider to be in your career ones that you would believe?
That's a good question. You want to make sure that you're accessing sites that are going to be reliable, that have done the due diligence, that have done their research before they post it. And that's going to take a time delay factor, unfortunately. Whether or not you hit the World Health Organization sites, whether or not you hit the CDC or you hit the individual hospital or university network sites, those three major sites will at least give you reliable, peer-reviewed, screened information. Mm-hmm. But there will be a delay processing that stuff. The social media with respect to Twitter and Facebook and anything else that you Google search on the internet will have, as you pointed out, Landon, false positives and true positives on there. And it's going to be very difficult to tease out what is real and what is fake from that perspective. The advantage is you get the news quicker, but how reliable that is going to be questionable. So the speed of transmission of information, while being excellent, is unfortunately tainted by some misinformation that's going to be out there. Mm-hmm. So I would still stick to the university sites, the official CDC sites, because at least you know they're going to give you the most concrete, reliable, up-to-date information that they can, and then filter carefully in your mind truth from untruth on any other website.
Perfect.
I think that's a good place for us to end. What do you think? Because I know that Robert has rounds to do. And Robert, I'm going to tell you, it's for very few people that I would get up this early and to have a chat with. But that was absolutely fascinating, and it was very, very helpful. And I thank you very much for helping. I think our nurses who are listening are going to find this very, very helpful. And as I said at the beginning, it's been very comforting for me to have all of the knowledge that we see, especially here in Canada in our news, where our infectious disease doctors and our scientists have really been leading how we manage this. And it has actually helped calm me down quite a bit. So I thank you very much for coming to speak to us. I thank everybody out there who is working in the trenches. And I'm going to let Landon say his three words that our BC health minister always says at the end of this. So I'm going to let you say those words. I want to thank all of you out there.
Yeah, Landon. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Reynolds. And I hope that as this progresses, Maybe you can come back someday and give us updates on the knowledge, because I'm sure you're very close to it, much closer than we are. And you always call her our health minister. She's not our health minister. She's our public health officer.
I know.
Provincial health officer.
Sorry.
Mother Bonnie is not our politician. I always resonate. Her quote always resonated with me of, this isn't forever. This is just for now. But I've noticed that she's maybe not being able to say that as much lately. And so, yeah. And I know you love her other of be kind.
Yeah.
Safe and be nice to each other, or whatever it ends with.
I know, right? I think it's be kind, be safe, be calm. Yeah. I think is what she usually says. But thank you so much, Robert. Any last words for us? Any last words of wisdom?
No. I think you guys have done well. I love Bonnie. She is so beautiful. And the demeanor is fantastic, and I love her words of wisdom. And yet, be kind, be safe. This is not forever. It is just for now.
For now.
Now may last by longer, but it is just for now. It will not be forever.
All right.
All right.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Bye.
For past episodes and to comment on this episode, please visit our website at nursem.org. That's nursem.org. You can follow us on Twitter at NursemCast and also find us on Facebook at Nursem Podcast. We look forward to your comments and suggestions for future episodes. Remember, before incorporating anything new into your work, ensure you are supported by your own scope of practice, workplace policies, and your own knowledge and comfort. The Nursem Podcast is brought to you by PRN Education, www.prneducation.ca.